This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. You just heard about this major decision about the future of the coal industry in Washington State. Let's learn more now. The Army Corps of Engineers has denied a key permit that might mean the end for plans to build one of America's biggest coal terminals off the shores of Cherry Point in Whatcom County. KUOW's environment reporter Ashley Ahern joins us live from the Lummi Reservation. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Good, good. This is the Gateway Pacific Terminal proposed to be near Lummi Island. The Lummi tribe protested. Why did the government side with the Lummis?
This terminal is not too far from Bellingham, Washington, far northwestern corner of the state. And the Army Corps of Engineers has been deliberating on this for almost five years now, back and forth with the proponents of the terminal and the tribe, who says this is going to affect their treaty entrusted fishing areas. So the tribe is heavily a fishing dependent community, and the Army Corps is saying if this coal terminal is built, we acknowledge that it will have more than minimal impacts on those treaty fishing rights, and therefore we cannot okay the permits for that terminal as it stands.
Tribal fishing rights. What does that decision mean, first of all, for countries who want our coal?
For countries who want our coal, they might not be getting it through. Well, they're definitely not getting it through Cherry Point. They could get it from other terminals on the West Coast, but this tribe has said pretty clearly that 400 plus of some of the largest ships on the planet would be servicing that terminal to bring that coal to Asia after it was taken off trains that were coming from Wyoming and Montana, where the mines are. And that those large ships have been shown to pull up crab pots in the area where Lummi fishermen are harvesting, as well as other tribes in the area. The Lummi are not the only one, but they have led the offense against the terminal because of those very direct impacts to their fishing area.
What does today's decision mean for the coal industry?
It sends a pretty chilling effect or chilling message. I think that this is pretty unprecedented for a tribe treaty from 1855 to prevent a development from going forward in 2016. I mean, it's pretty big news. Doesn't happen that I'm aware of in this region very often, maybe never. So I think that all eyes will now be looking towards the Millennium Bulk Terminal, which is proposed for Longview, which would be almost as big as this, which is still on the table and is in the environmental review process and is still on the table. It's the only big game in town anymore for moving coal through the Northwest at this point. But Bill, it was a really emotional. The tribal council had a meeting just now that I was in, and there were tears, and elders were in the room, and then it was just ended with singing and drumming from some of the tribal youth. The whole community came out. They're having a luncheon there right now, and it's just really it's really clear that this is not some issue that some tribal leaders were taking on without the whole community behind them. I mean, it's really kind of surprising how many people came out in the middle of the day on a Monday to just celebrate this news. Very emotional time here on the reservation.
As you say, this deliberation has gone on for 5 years. Why did it take that long for the Corps to decide?
They had to really make sure they had their ducks in a row. I mean, they could very well still be sued. We'll find out. And they needed to make sure that they had all of the evidence. So there was a lot of back and forth with the Lummi to say, okay, if these are your fishing areas, please show as much documentation as you can as to where you're fishing, how many fishermen are using those areas, what you're catching, so that when they potentially go to court for this, they can kind of back up their decision with good documentation. Now it's just kind of showing their work, but they wanted to be extra certain. And they also went back to the proponents of the coal terminal, SSA Marine and PIT, to just kind of make sure that did the companies want to change the way the terminal was designed. And I think there was some back and forth in the actual design of the terminal to see if the companies could make the tribe happy. And ultimately the tribe just said, no, we can't see how this is going to do anything but negatively impact our subsistence and treaty insured fishing rights.
So to sum up, Ashley, again, the Corps of Engineers denying this permit for this big terminal off the shores of Cherry Point. What are the odds of a lawsuit? What are the odds of a terminal at Longview on the Columbia?
It's too soon to say in terms of a lawsuit. I'm going to be poking around on that more today. The terminal on the Columbia, I mean, there are tribal interests down there. I don't know that those tribal treaty interests are as strong or well lawyered up as they are up here. But there's certainly a pretty strong opposition mounting down there. That said, Longview does have a very blue collar and kind of has been more open to the idea of a coal terminal in their community than nearby Bellingham, Washington, and the Lummi area up here. So the analysts I've talked to, the economic gurus here on the coal industry right now, are saying, exporting coal is not a strong decision no matter where you move it, and they are not putting a big vote of confidence in the Longview terminal either. But we'll see. We'll be following that. EarthFix will continue to be following that closely.
Yes, indeed. KUOW Environment Reporter, EarthFix Reporter Ashley Ahern, live from the Lummi Reservation today. Ashley, thank you.
Anytime.
Again, Corps of Engineers deciding no on a permit for the Gateway Pacific Terminal project proposed for Cherry Point in Whatcom County. This is The Record. More coming up on the environment and hazardous waste, where it should go, where it does go. Stay tuned. You buy a new phone, a new computer, you take your old one to a local recycler because you are diligent. You are responsible. It's the green thing to do, right? Well, it turns out a lot of those devices might not be getting recycled. The United States is the biggest producer of electronic waste, almost 8 million tons a year. One man has made it his life's mission to track down what actually happens to that e-waste. Our EarthFix team checked it out. Here's reporter Ken Christensen.
We're on a plane headed to Hong Kong. Once in the air, most of the passengers fall fast asleep. But not Jim Puckett. He's got Wi-Fi on his laptop. His eyes are fixed to the screen. He zooms into a map dotted with little orange markers. He's charting a path for his next investigation.
Most of the public still thinks a recycler is a recycler and that they're going to recycle it right there in America. They have the right to know where their stuff goes.
Puckett's the founder of the Basel Action Network. It's an e-waste watchdog group in Seattle. They recently partnered with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and put GPS tracking devices in 200 old computers, printers, and TVs. Then they dropped them off in locations across the country, at recycling facilities, donation centers, and electronics take-back programs.
And the little devices went out and spoke to us, saying, "This is where I am."
Around a third of the tracked electronics were exported. Of those, most ended up in Hong Kong. Now Puckett is following those devices halfway around the world to see what happens to them.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hong Kong.
Puckett has been investigating e-waste for almost 20 years. In 2001, he uncovered a town in China that's become known as the world's electronics graveyard. He produced a documentary that showed residents cooking electronics to extract metals like gold and copper, poisoning themselves and their environment. In response to Puckett's film, the Chinese government cracked down. But now, years later, the problem has popped up in rural Hong Kong.
Sure enough, it's still going on. This is really a dirty little secret.
Turn right onto Tin Fog Road.
The next morning, Puckett drives out to a border region between Hong Kong and mainland China. Paved streets give way to rutted dirt roads. He looks down at those little orange dots on his map. Each one represents a location where tracked electronics ended up. He follows the signals on his GPS tracking device.
Yeah, we're getting the closest we've been. 100 feet away. 80, 77 feet, 73.
Yep.
Let me just, stop, and I'll just look through the fence.
Puckett peeks through a crack in the wall.
Oh my God. We got to get in there.
Losai! Lo-lo-ban!
That's Dong Xia Su, our translator. She tells a man on the other side of the fence that they want to buy old printers. The door opens. It's an open-air dirt lot about the size of a gymnasium. We follow a path around mountains of printers piled 15 feet high.
Look at this toner.
Old printers contain toner dust, a possible carcinogen. About 10 workers use power drills to dismantle them. They're not wearing face masks. Their aprons are caked with black printer dust. Puckett says in the past, this area served as a gateway to mainland China.
It was a staging place for repackaging and putting things on smaller trucks for smuggling into mainland.
Now, the hazardous waste is ending up here. Workstations are littered with broken fluorescent glass tubes. Each contains mercury vapor.
This is one of the more toxic metals. This is a concern when they were taking apart these LCD screens and breaking them right in front of their faces and breathing in the mercury at that time.
Our translator talks to a worker.
I asked him that if he knows the wipe tubes are dangerous. He has no idea.
Puckett enters a quiet section of another e-waste warehouse. He finds electronics with labels from companies in Washington State and Oregon.
It's getting close to home here. Jeez.
The next box reveals a company even closer to home.
This is Total Reclaim. This is Seattle. Look at this. Earth Day Recycling. Total Reclaim's logo all over it.
Total Reclaim is one of the largest electronics recyclers in the Northwest. They handle e-waste from the city of Seattle, King County, the University of Washington, and the state of Washington, among others. It has a strict no-export policy. So, how did this happen? The owners of Total Reclaim, Craig Lorch and Jeff Zirkel, declined to participate in a recorded interview. But in a phone call, Lorch said, quote, "Our stuff was over there, and we take responsibility for that." He said their LCD TVs ended up in Hong Kong because the company is struggling financially. It's harder than ever to make money in the recycling business. Commodities like steel, copper, and plastic are losing value. It's simply more profitable to send electronics overseas. Total Reclaim isn't alone. In all, the investigation found that 70 U.S. recyclers took in electronics that ended up in China, Thailand, Pakistan, Taiwan, Mexico, and Kenya. But most of the tracked devices went to the junkyards of rural Hong Kong.
These e-waste yards tend to operate in a shady manner.
Jackson Lau is the head of Hong Kong's Recycling Association. He says exporters often mislabel electronics as raw plastics or as reusable electronics to get through customs.
Hong Kong government should try harder to enforce strict regulations to ban illegal e-waste, as well as enlist the help from other countries who exported it.
The United States is the only developed country that hasn't ratified an international treaty to stop first world countries from dumping hazardous e-waste on developing nations. Washington and Oregon have some of the most comprehensive e-waste laws in the country. They collect fees from electronics manufacturers to subsidize recycling. But states don't have jurisdiction to ban exports.
Flat-screened pieces, just dumped.
As long as market forces are driving recyclers to export, Jim Puckett is fighting an uphill battle.
I'll just keep going until we've solved it. We got to keep going.
Without a federal law banning the export of e-waste, there's little incentive for the industry to change. I'm Ken Christensen in Hong Kong.
And you'll find a video report from that trip to Hong Kong at our website. It gives you some great visuals to understand this, and you'll learn a lot about the issue at KUOW.org. That story was co-reported by EarthFix's Katie Campbell. I asked Katie, how should e-waste be handled?
Well, the right way for e-waste to be handled is for us to take it to a recycler and for the recycler to process it here in the United States, where they take out all the hazardous material really carefully and safely and find a way to reuse every single piece of material that's in that recycled electronic.
To reuse it, is there a way to safely dispose of something that is just not going to get reused?
Well, we visited one recycling facility, the largest company in the country, Electronics Recycling International. And what we saw there is that they had a 99% no waste process.
Mm-hmm.
So 99% of everything that went through their facility ended up going to be reused, and only a portion of the percent was not able to be reused in some way.
Okay, so there's a way to do it carefully, and we just heard in that piece of reporting one reason it's not happening, that's commodity prices. It's just that stuff, it's not as lucrative to sell it. But why isn't there more of a legal roadblock to sending off waste to be dumped?
Well, that's a good question, Bill, and I'm not sure the entire answer to that. The United States is the only country in the developed world that hasn't signed on to this international treaty called the Basel Convention. And the only thing that's preventing them from being a part of this is that we haven't passed the laws that say that we need to recycle our electronics here in the United States and that we're not going to export non-working electronics that have hazardous materials inside of them to third world countries. That's all we need to do.
Why haven't we passed laws like that?
You know, I think that there's been organizations that have lobbied against them, trade organizations that have lobbied against them, saying this would hurt the recycling sector and saying that it's really not that big of an issue. They're saying that the amount of recycled electronics that end up getting exported is really just a sliver of the market. So they're saying that that's just not, those laws aren't needed and would be too much of a hurt on the recycling sector.
Well, reporting like yours at EarthFix can shine a light on the cost of that situation. Have you gotten any reaction from companies or from governments to your reporting?
So far, one of the biggest electronics recyclers in the Pacific Northwest, Total Reclaim, was caught out in this report and was found and actually admitted to sending LCD TVs to Hong Kong. And as a result of that, they've been kicked out of this certification program for the next 2 years. And that certification program that they've signed on to says that they will not export. So by being a part of that certification program, they've gotten larger government contracts from the city of Seattle, from King County, from the state of Washington, from the University of Washington, because those organizations have signed on to only recycle their electronics with companies that don't export. So there's already been some fallout for them from this, and there's continuing ongoing investigations in Washington and Oregon into Total Reclaim.
So there are a lot of holes in the system. I don't know who to trust. I don't want these workers in Hong Kong or any place else inhaling mercury vapor and toner dust. But what am I supposed to do about it? I've got old computers and appliances. What do I do?
I think that's a great question, and I don't know that I have a great answer for you. I think that what this investigation has shown is that even the best of the best recyclers who have signed on to the most strict certification programs and who are audited regularly by state organizations, they can't guarantee 100% that things aren't going to end up overseas. But I think one easy thing is that we can reduce the amount of things that we buy in the first place and try and figure out ways to reuse the things that we do have so that we aren't contributing more waste to this problem. And I think the longer term question is, how do we actually figure out how to fund and pay for our electronics to be recycled is the next big question to tackle.
And in the meantime, Katie, what would you recommend I do with the computer and stereo receiver? And, you know, I save this stuff and it's sitting in my garage until I figure out the wise, safe thing to do with it. Any advice?
I have done the same thing. I have a stack of old cell phones and old computers
right
in my closet as well. And I honestly don't know where to take it to know for sure.
Yeah, so it just sits there, huh?
It just sits there. I mean, I feel guilty about it, too. I don't know exactly what to do with these things.
Feeling guilty right along with you. That's Katie Campbell with our EarthFix reporting team, showing you how the biggest electronic recycling company in Washington is getting investigated for secretly exporting appliances to unregulated scrapyards in Hong Kong. And also talking about your part in the whole thing. This is The Record. Coming up on the program, why would you give a box in a bed to a baby? Every day, social workers reach out to homeless people on the streets of Seattle. But there's one place social workers seldom go because it's considered dangerous, the jungle. That's the common name for a homeless encampment under I-5 where there have been rapes, stabbings, and infamous shooting. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols introduces you to some of the outreach workers who do dare to go to the jungle.
Ask anybody in the jungle. Who reaches out to you? Who offers help?
The only person I had come talk to me about any kind of outreach was Liz and them. Nobody else has come to talk to us about it.
That's Cheryl Oliver, who lives in the jungle. By Liz and them, she means Liz Curtis and a nonprofit group called Heroes for the Homeless. Heroes saw the lack of outreach in the jungle, the void, so they stepped into that void.
Good morning, Heroes for the Homeless. Anybody home? We have food and supplies.
There are other organizations that do what Curtis and her group do. Some of them get money from the city, but those groups rarely come here.
Liz, I was noticing that big can of chicken breast. Is that for anybody specific?
That is for you.
Thank you. That'll save me from going to the food bank today.
Curtis does this once or twice a month because she can't forget the people she's met here.
Coming down here and having face-to-face contact and saying, how are you? And I think a lot of that has made it so that I stop seeing homelessness as a blight on society. It's more, you know, these are real people, and how close are you to homelessness, you know?
Hours later, Curtis and her team are finally done handing out all their stuff. Liz has given her whole morning to this work. It's not like she has a lot of extra time. She's a legal assistant who attends community college at night.
So I'll leave here and go home and write a final paper, even though I've been up since 3 o'clock this morning.
It takes that kind of person to volunteer their time here in the jungle. Sola Plumacher works for Seattle's Human Services Department. She manages the city's contracts with outreach workers. I asked her if the outreach workers paid by the city should be required to go into the jungle.
Well, I think the response in the jungle is challenging because it is a very isolated area.
There are a lot of places to hide, and there's been a history of violence there. Even firefighters only go in with a police escort. But that danger doesn't stand in the way of this next guy. He shows up in the jungle every weekend.
My name is John Meir.
Meir directs a ministry called Light Under the Bridge. He runs a pancake breakfast in the jungle every Saturday morning. He comes on holidays, too, like Thanksgiving. And on those days, he brings extra treats.
Apple pie, pumpkin pie, and the stuff that goes on top of the pies, which is a lot of fun.
Meir doesn't bring his crew of volunteers as far into the jungle as Liz Curtis does, but he has a lot of equipment to carry. Big, heavy speakers, for example.
We're going to have eggs!
Hey.
We're going to have toast!
Toast!
We're going to have the Holy Ghost!
Holy Ghost!
Hallelujah!
Just like Heroes for the Homeless, Meir saw the absence of services here. He wanted to do something about it.
I want my life to count.
Meir is a man on a mission, but he's also been down and out. Once, he was drunk and dangerous.
13 years ago, I tried to kill somebody, Joshua, and I don't do that no more.
Now he's more likely to wash somebody's feet. He has literally done that in the jungle.
And you should have seen this guy. He was like, wow, wow.
But he doesn't let people push him around either.
Like the guy with the basketball, for example.
One time, this guy came by and threw a basketball at the breakfast table.
And the coffee runs into the brand new Bibles that we got.
The Bible says that we come against the strong man. And if there's more of us getting against that strong man, we're going to boot him out.
And the next thing, I probably shouldn't tell you this, I grabbed this guy's arm and twisted this arm and started dragging him down the road. How dare you come in here? In the name of Jesus, we're here for love and blah, blah, blah. And here I'm acting like this. And he's going, ah!
Meir says he's an imperfect man, and we all have things we work on. He's working on his temper. But whatever his temperament, in this place, he's the outsider who visits most frequently. Because, again, city-funded outreach workers almost never go there.
And that's the type of situation we really want to change here.
Scott Lindsay is with the mayor's office. He admits there's an absence of outreach services in the jungle.
So we're trying to turn that around and really flood this area with law enforcement and outreach workers.
Here's the difference between paid outreach workers and volunteers. Volunteers show up when they can fit it into their busy schedules. That usually means Saturday mornings. And volunteers bring their own personal reasons for doing what they do. Paid outreach workers could show up more often, maybe even every day, like they do in parts of downtown and Capitol Hill. And they'd be more likely to have professional training. The mayor's plan for the jungle is still in development. We hear his office is leaning towards installing gates at 10 major intersections where homeless people and outreach workers enter the jungle. People will still live there, but access to and escape from a partially blocked-off jungle could become more difficult. No word yet on which outreach workers will get a key to those gates. In the jungle, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
All this month, we're taking a deep look at the jungle, what it is, why it's there. You'll find our stories at KUOW.org, search for jungle. And we want to hear from you. What is the city's responsibility to the people who live under the freeway? And how did you come to that point of view? Call our listener feedback line and leave your response. It's 206-221-3663, 221-3663. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Across the United States, nearly 3,500 infants die every year from sudden unexpected infant death syndrome, SUIDS. You may know the related term, SIDS. That's a subcategory. 7 families in King County lost infants last year to SUIDS. In some cases, these babies are dying from suffocation because they're not sleeping safely. Sometimes they're not in a crib. Instead, they are sleeping in bed with their parents.
All parents want to have a safe place for their babies. And sometimes for some parents, that safe place was being right next to them. And it wasn't like the parents wanted to have an unsafe situation for their baby. They really wanted to have their babies close. That was the most important thing for them. And that's how they felt they were keeping their babies safe.
That's Rebecca Benson, a nurse with King County. The county's public health department is giving baby bed boxes. Literally, a small cardboard box with a firm mattress at the bottom to families who need one to help keep infants safe during sleep. Benson told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel why these simple cardboard boxes can be a lifesaver.
So we've had situations where a family is sleeping on the floor with multiple children, maybe several mattresses. An infant has fallen between those mattresses or between the wall and the mattress. So a situation where the infant does not have their own safe place to sleep.
How does giving a family a box like this help infants stay safe during sleep?
They have their own space. There's not a concern for, say, blankets or pillows rolling over the top of them, or being too warm in a bed with other adults or other children. That's one of the risk factors for SIDS and SUIDS is overheating. So it's their own little safe spot.
You and I were talking before we started recording, and I told you a little bit about what it was like when I brought home my baby. I fell asleep with her more than once. I accidentally co-slept with her, essentially. I think that's a not uncommon experience for new parents. They just fall asleep with their infant. So even in that situation where they're accidentally falling asleep with their infant, they may have the best of intentions. What's a way to ensure, to preset conditions to ensure a safe experience?
Well, first of all, what I want to say is that most parents really want to be really close to their infants, and they're especially then, you know, when they're first bringing their baby home, you fall in love with that baby and you want to be close to them. And there are times where you're holding on to them and they're going to fall asleep. If you're awake and they're falling asleep on you, that's just a really wonderful way to continue to bond with your baby. The falling asleep with your baby, that just happens. We never want to make a parent feel bad that could happen. The biggest message that we want to have is when you're putting your baby down for sleep, putting them into a safe sleep situation.
Do you think that doctors and nurses, medical professionals who work with pregnant women, with new parents, can do a better job of educating them about safe sleep?
I think our medical professionals do a really good job of addressing the safe sleep message. Oftentimes what happens, though, like when you give birth and you've just had your baby, there's oftentimes a lot of hectic information that's given. You're excited, you may be sleep deprived, you may be really tired because you've had a long labor, and then there's a number of health messages that are needed to be told to you while you're in the hospital. And sometimes those messages kind of get lost or forgotten or, you know, just like, I'm so tired, I don't remember that. You know, so I think the important thing is that even after those messages are given by a medical professional, either before the baby's born or in the hospital, it's important for them to be followed up with after the baby is born, when the parent maybe has a little bit more, has had some sleep, has had some time to recoup and really just, you know, be ready to hear that message again.
This is something that you've thought about not just as a nurse, but as a parent as well. What's your own personal connection to thinking about babies and sleeping?
Yes. So I grew up in a very large family. I'm number 7 of 8 children. And my mother had the great fortune of having an amazing obstetrician, a woman obstetrician at the time, that most women were formula feeding their babies. She was a big proponent in breastfeeding. And that included breastfeeding and having your babies in bed with you so that it made it easier to breastfeed. So each one of us in my family got about a year in our parents' bed. And you know, that was a source of great pride for my mom, and she passed that on to us, of course. You know, so when I had my children, you know, it was expected that, for one thing, that I would breastfeed, and that family culture of sharing the bed with our babies was okay. So, you know, as the years have gone by. I became a public health nurse, and I started looking at different situations and really realizing that babies really are safest if they have their own safe place to sleep.
So what did that do to your thinking about how you grew up, how you slept with your own kids when you were bringing them home from the hospital?
I was probably just really, really fortunate that I didn't have a tragedy that some families have had.
Rebecca Benson with King County's Nurse Family Partnership told Jeannie Yandel about the county giving out baby bed boxes to any family who needs one to reduce infant mortality. By the way, since the 1930s, every new family in Finland is given a baby bed box filled with other essentials, sleeping clothes, soap, diapers. Finland has the 7th lowest infant mortality rate in the world. The United States ranks 58th. I'm Bill Radke with KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. The biggest neighborhood transformation in Seattle is happening now at the city's oldest public housing project. For generations, Yesler Terrace has provided a home, and it's provided a leg up to low-income families. It's also on prime central Seattle real estate. The city has brought in developers to turn Yesler Terrace into a mixed-income development, a dense one. It could become twice as dense as Capitol Hill. From the Puget Sound Business Journal, managing editor Emily Parkhurst told me why this redevelopment is happening.
Yesler Terrace has been there since 1941. It's a really old development, and it is basically falling apart. There's a lot of buildings there that really desperately needed to be redeveloped. And so the city council passed a $290 million investment in the neighborhood to really rebuild it. But a lot of that money is going to come from private developers, and they're going to sell big chunks of this. The Seattle Housing Authority is going to sell big chunks of this to private developers. So it's very much a public-private partnership, which is something that I think a lot of people were hoping to see for the neighborhood. And for a while there, you know, there was, you know, this property was listed and nothing was happening, and there was questions about whether it was actually going to work. And then suddenly, very recently in January, Vulcan Real Estate, which is Paul Allen's real estate development company, swooped in and scooped up about $22 million worth of the property there, and since then has announced plans to develop 3 new apartment buildings, and that has a lot more developers interested in the property.
Yes. Yeah, so why, you said that the place is falling apart, but is that the city's only motive? You talk about a private partnership and bringing in zillionaires. Why is the city really doing this?
Well, you know, this is basically the projects. This is an area that has been economically depressed for a long time, and it's right in the middle of the city. It's basically right between the International District and First Hill. It's right near Pill Hill, where all those hospitals are. It's a prime spot for, you know, some really great developments, for a good neighborhood, and as it's been very much neglected. And I think that the city identified that as an opportunity to really bring some upward mobility for the folks who have lived there for a long time by bringing in some mixed income housing as well as the low income housing that has been there. And right now there's no jobs in Yesler Terrace. Like, basically no jobs. And with some of the developments that could go in there, there's going to be office buildings, there's going to be a lot more opportunities for people who live there to also work there.
What kind of person lives in Yesler Terrace now?
Well, right now it's an incredibly diverse neighborhood. The residents there, they speak 15 different languages. It's a lot of recent immigrants and first-generation Americans there. The average income for the neighborhood is about $16,000 a year, so it's very much a low-income neighborhood.
Let's talk about this as a business story. Emily, you're writing for the Puget Sound Business Journal, putting a low-income housing project on your front page. Why is this interesting to your readers as a business development?
Well, you know, we kind of proposed this story initially as, you know, this is a $1.7 billion development when all is said and done. And that is, you know, that's a massive redevelopment of a big chunk of our city. It's really an impressive feat, and I think nobody really knows that it's happening. I think, you know, a few people are aware that it's happening, but just how massive a redevelopment this is. South Lake Union and the Denny Triangle, that's where a lot of people are focusing their attention. But now that Vulcan has made this big investment into what is essentially Seattle's projects, I think a lot of people are turning their attention there, and we felt like it was really important to highlight some of the opportunities that exist for the real estate development community, but also some of the opportunities for some of the folks who have lived there. We discovered in our reporting that Washington Governor Gary Locke grew up there, and he took us on a walk through the neighborhood and talked about growing up there, and obviously the subsidized housing there provided his family the upward mobility they needed to then buy a house on Beacon Hill and get out of the projects, and he went on to become governor of Washington. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity there, and we felt like it was really important to focus on that.
Talking with Emily Parkhurst from the Puget Sound Business Journal. Emily, I think the overriding question around Yesler Terrace is here you have this place that was for low-income people, and over time it becomes an incredibly desirable location right in the middle of this now in-demand city. Here comes all this money, these developers, and what are the odds that the have-nots are not going to lose out like happens so often? What's going to happen to prevent us looking back and saying, yeah, they got the shaft?
Yeah, well, I think that is something that the Seattle Housing Authority is really concerned about and something that they've been focused on. And by designating these apartments as a certain percentage of them has to be low income, a certain percentage of them has to be what they call middle income, so it's people who still are below a certain threshold, then and they've made space for everybody who is currently there. So there are more apartments, in fact, than there are currently under the existing redevelopment. So there's going to be more opportunity for people who live there and even more low-income housing right in the middle of the city. And I think that that's huge when we're talking about a city that is struggling right now with affordable housing. To have this neighborhood here where there's, you know, these designated apartments that are you have to make below a certain amount in order to live there is going to preserve some of that.
Puget Sound Business Journal Managing Editor Emily Parkhurst telling you about the redevelopment of Seattle's oldest public housing project, Yesler Terrace. Thanks for joining us here on KUOW's The Record. The apparent Republican presidential nominee was here in Western Washington over the weekend. Donald Trump held a rally in Linden outside of Bellingham ahead of the May 24th Washington primary. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders has won several states, including Washington, but Hillary Clinton is expected to be the nominee. Would that mean that the Sanders movement disappears? No, says radio host Amy Goodman. She's been tracking political movements for 20 years now on her progressive public radio show Democracy Now! Goodman told me Bernie didn't start the burn. He's just tapping into the energy of the Occupy movement of a few years ago.
I think he's riding that wave, and he's a very significant figure. I don't know what will happen with Bernie Sanders. You know, I can't predict anything, whether he could get the nomination, it doesn't look likely right now, or whether he would take a different path. But what most interests me is these movements that are coalescing. I mean, you look at not only the movement to challenge inequality, the immigrants' rights movement, the Black Lives Matter movement that had a big effect on his campaign and Hillary Clinton's campaign. I mean,
famously in Seattle, do you know about that Westlake rally where Black Lives Matter movement participants jumped up on stage with Bernie Sanders? that caught fire nationally.
That's true. And they challenge him at Netroots Nation, and they go behind the scenes, behind closed doors, at Hillary Clinton's fundraisers, like the one she held in Charleston, South Carolina. A young African-American woman holds up a banner, "I am not a super predator," referring to a statement Hillary Clinton made in 1996. And you put all of this together with the endless war, the fact that right now in this country, the U.S. is involved in the longest war in U.S. history in Afghanistan. I mean, I think we're seeing a kind of convergence, and we don't know exactly where it will go. But what's most interesting is that these movements are growing, and they're making demands, structural demands that will change this country.
Do you think, Amy Goodman, that we're at the beginning of a progressive movement that right now is part Sanders and part Trump? The one that could coalesce around anti-free trade deals, anti-billionaire bailouts, anti-corporate politics, pro-single-payer health care, pro-safety net, and it just needs the next progressive national figure to unite those factions and the Green Party, et cetera, into a majority.
It's hard to think about Donald Trump in that way because although he says, for example, he was opposed to the war in Iraq at the time, he was not opposed to the war in Iraq. While he says at different times he was for single-payer, now he says it's not about single payer. You have this other issue that cannot be minimized in any way, his racist xenophobia. This issue when he was asked by Jake Tapper on CNN if he would disavow the support of a Klan leader, David Duke, disavow the support of the Klan. He waffled. And this cannot be minimized, what he represents in that way, terrifying populations in this country. We can't forget what the Klan did. You know, September 11th, horrific moment, 3,000 people incinerated in an instant. Wasn't the first time terror came to U.S. soil, though.
And but I'm taking my cue from you and looking beyond a person and talking about, could we be, it's strange to talk about a movement that involves some Trump voters and some Sanders voters, but I just wonder if you see the beginnings of something different.
I mean, there's no question that people are fed up with the establishment. They see that it is not serving them. We're seeing the largest concentration of wealth go from the bottom to the top that we've seen in over 100 years. We are at a juncture right now. I've been traveling the country in a 100-city tour. I'm at city 50 right now, halfway through. Every campus I go to, the students are occupying administration offices calling for fossil-free America, fossil-free universities. People are ready for a change, ready to change their lifestyle because they see that the planet can't afford this anymore, and they can't afford the planet anymore. I think we are at a turning point.
You talked with Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant, who said she wants Bernie Sanders to run as a third-party candidate. What effect do you think that would have?
I mean, this is a movement, Bernie or bust, and it's a very significant one, saying we will not take just the best of the worst. We want to support the candidate. We want not just in primaries or caucuses, but in the general election. But then you also have, we talked to, you know, the former Seattle mayor, Mike McGinn, and he is a Bernie Sanders supporter, but said if Hillary Clinton gets the nomination, he would support her because he cannot countenance Trump. These movements, we're going to see where they go. But what's really important is they are galvanizing whole populations that haven't voted before. And if too many voting rights impediments are not put in the way with the evisceration of the Voting Rights Act, we're going to see especially young people feeling like, my gosh, they have a place in determining the future of this country, that their voices will be heard one way or another.
We've been talking about presidential politics, but as you know, Seattle passed a $15 minimum wage, paid parental leave for city workers, helped Washington State pass same-sex marriage, legal marijuana. Those are spreading movements. So how much does the United States presidency matter in the big picture?
You're right that what's happening at the state level and at local levels make a huge difference now, especially with the stalemate in Washington. And what's happened with Seattle paving the way around the $15 minimum wage movement, I come from New York. Our governor, who is a Democrat, Andrew Cuomo, had said when people were calling for $15 an hour, basically he said, you've got to be kidding, it's pie in the sky. And now he's hailing it and signing legislation around it. You know, Nelson Mandela said, you know, it always seems impossible until it's done. And that's what we are seeing. I mean, what has happened in Seattle in so many ways has had a significant impact around the country. And following these local movements with global implications, I do think is the way to go, that the local, the municipalities, the state are going to show Congress what they have to do.
Talking with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, who's been covering movements for 20 years and is doing so today, what do you want to leave our listeners with? What's the message you want to send us?
Well, in addition to all of the movements I've mentioned, we have to support independent media. It is absolutely critical because we need a media that gives voice to people who care about war and peace, who care about inequality, who care about the fate of the planet, climate change. I don't think that's a fringe minority, not a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take the media back. It is the place where we have a conversation, a global conversation that everyone must be included in. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day, war and peace, life and death, and anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country. They can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us in civilian society to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they live or die, whether they're sent to kill or be killed. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society.
And what can a listener do on behalf of a diverse media?
Be a part of it and support public media, support public radio, public television, tune in. We have to challenge the corporate media and we have to build our own media. And I think, you know, that's what we chronicle in our new book, Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. It's going to where the silence is.
Amy Goodman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amy Goodman, host and executive director of the public radio show Democracy Now!, launched 20 years ago, and you can hear it on 91.3 KBCS in Bellevue. In the news today, House Speaker Paul Ryan says he would step down as co-chair of the Republican convention if Donald Trump asked him to. It's setting up to be an awkward convention, with Ryan saying he's not ready to endorse the apparent nominee. We'll keep bringing you news and analysis right here on KUOW.